So I'm going to talk about spin forms, and for once I'll follow Carlo's suggestion about doing something else than 3D gravity. So I'll try about 4D gravity. So first, what are spin forms? So spin forms, it's a path integral formalism for gravity. So we start with an action, I mean, for gravity. So usually we use the metric, or for spin form we use the first order formalism, so in terms of a triad and a connection. And we want to discretize and quantize the path integral. So here M is the manifold, the 4D manifold that I'm working on. So now I'm going to discretize that, and so here I'll put the discrete equivalent of the field that I'm using and some amplitude depending on a triangulation of my manifold, which depends on these discrete fields. So a spin form model is a choice of amplitude here. So the first question that you can ask, it's here I've taken a manifold and discretized it. So should I just take any triangulation of my manifold? Or should I take a triangulation, or should I sum over different triangulations that represent the same manifold? Or should I sum over all triangulations that look like my manifold at some scale? So usually in gravity, we don't know really how to answer these questions. But at least in a special class of theories, BF theories, which are topological, then we know that we need only one triangulation of a manifold. These theories are simple because they are topological in the sense that they have a zero degree of freedom. So basically, when you go from the continuum to discrete action, then you're not losing anything because there was nothing in the theory. Fortunately, gravity, we can almost write it as a BF theory plus some extra stuff. But unfortunately, gravity has degrees of freedom, so we still face the problem of knowing what we do with the triangulations. Now, here I stayed pretty generic, and I've talked about triangulation, but I want to talk about spin form. So where's the spin form here? So if I start with a triangulation, a 4D triangulation, it's made of 4 simplices. That thing is supposed to represent a 4 simplex, like a 4-dimensional cell, which is made of 5 points and all the links between them. Yeah, I'm great at drawing. So the triangulation is made of these 4 simplices, which are glued together along tetrahedras. And the tetrahedras are glued along triangles, and then there's edges and points. So the spin form is the dual of a triangulation. So this guy is just going to become a point. This guy is going to become a link. So if I take 2 4 simplices and 1 tetrahedron in the middle, then the link is just linking the 2 4 simplices. And then the triangle is going to become a face. And the spin form is only the two complex. So I don't care about only these 3 levels, and I don't care about the rest. So maybe it's nice to understand a bit better what's the dual face of a triangle to get a little idea. So basically, if I look at 1 4 simplex, and the next 4 simplex, which is related by a tetrahedra. And I can go along that, following like tetrahedras and a new 4 simplex, another tetrahedra, and so on, until it loops. And this is the face dual to a triangle, which is basically going around all the 4 simplices that share the same triangle. Well, I hope this is clear. And so now a spin form model is usually a local choice of a local model. So it means that I take the amplitude for a triangulation, it's going to be some sum of, depending on the fields, it's going to be a product of amplitudes which correspond to the edges and amplitudes which correspond to the vertices. I didn't put amplitudes which correspond to the faces because usually they're put into the measure. So these are just spin four models. And the next step after that, maybe I'll change board, is to go from between this thing to what we call group field theory. Yes, so group field theories, it's just about noticing that this guy has, it really looks like a Feynman diagram evaluation. I have vertices, I've got edges, I have amplitudes attached to each of them, and I'm going to evaluate them. And so now I'm saying that I want this guy, this amplitude, to be the evolution of a Feynman diagram of a certain theory. And that theory is what we call a group field theory. So in more details, what happens is that the edge corresponds to a tetrahedra, as I said earlier. The tetrahedra, I mean, in this theories, the degrees of freedom are somehow on the triangles. I'll tell that in more details afterwards. The tetrahedra is made of four triangles. So this edge, will have like four index somehow. I'll write it like that for a moment. I'll tell you what I mean more afterwards. And these vertices, which correspond to the four simplex, which looks like that, is going to be made of five tetrahedras meeting together. So what does all this mean? I want this to become the propagator of my group field theory. And this, I want it to be the interaction vertex. So somehow here, the theory that I'm going to write is something like 1 over amplitude of of the edge, phi phi, plus lambda times AV. Of phi to the power 5, because I've got 5 tetrahedras here. So what happens is that if I look now at the Feynman diagrams of this theory, I am going to generate these two types of objects, which I'm going to glue, and which are going to form the triangulation. And then the evaluation of this of the Feynman diagram is going to be exactly my spin form amplitude. So now, this kind of theory actually really looks like matrix models that we use in string theory in two dimensions. It's just a higher dimensional generalization. It works in any dimension, not only in four dimensions. It's a bit more complicated because now we have just a matrix, it has more index, and there's more sum, so it's a bit more complicated, but it's the same idea, but you use the group theory to generate a sum of a triangulation and thus a sum of a manifolds, which allows to consider topology change and all this stuff. But up to now, we don't quite know what to do with the group theories in spin form, meaning we can't compute them, the pattern function exactly, and apart from that, we don't know what to do with them. So now, let's start talking about 4D spin forms. So the whole spin form quantization of gravity is based on a rough formulation of gravity as a constrained BF theory. What I mean is that we start with a Palatini action. Which is a function of the tetrad field and the spin connection. So here the fields are the tetrad, where these guys are the space-time indices and this is the internal Lorentz index. So they both run from 0 to 3. And the connection here, it's a one form connection valued in the Lorentz group. And that's the curvature. So if I think I put all the index at the right place. So when you look at that, you see that here, somehow you'd like to put all that in one piece, which I just call B. Why would I like to do that? It's that when you do the canonical analysis of this theory, you see that this guy is the conjugate variable to the connection. Ah, so I just call this conjugate variable B. Now, because B is expressed in that particular way, we're going to get constraints on B, which in the canonical approach are second class constraints, which in loop quantum relativity usually they correspond to the reality conditions. B? Ah, crap. So what are these conditions? It's just a condition that we write. I'll just write it below. So I'm going to get a quadratic constraint on my B field, and this is the Lagrange multiplier for that constraint. So I just.
So you don't distinguish between uppercase and
lowercase? Yes, I do, but here it's just a Lagrange multiplier, so I don't care about it. But okay. this guy is a Lagrange multiplier, which is kind of special. It's anti-symmetric under like I and J and K and L. It's symmetric under exchange of IJ and KL. Basically the same symmetries as this guy. But the important thing is that it vanishes on epsilon. So basically this condition just tells you that the only free part of Bij wedge BKL is epsilon IJKL. So the condition that is imposed is that Bij wedge BKL is proportional to epsilon IJKL. So naturally here I'll call the factor B. B is 1 over 24 times epsilon IJKL Bij wedge BKL. So the point is that this condition imposes that B is of that type. Well, actually, it's a bit more subtle than that. There's four sectors that appear, and not only the one that we want. Yes, in the Lorentz algebra. Yes. So this is valued in the Lorentz algebra.
And you use Lorentz metric to raise.
Yes.
And lower basis.
Yeah.
Okay. So now you can write them wherever you want.
Okay. So all these objects are valued in the Lorentz algebra. So I was saying, okay, so B, Bij, there's four sectors, as I was saying. There's the right sector, epsilon IJKL, but I can also have its opposite because this is a quadratic condition, so it doesn't see the sign. But I can also have another sector, which is without the epsilon. So this guy is going to give you the Palatini action, and this one is something slightly different, meaning which is not general relativity, but it's actually a simpler theory. So if I start with this action here, and I look at the equations of motions, I'm going to get two equations. So if I do the variation with respect to E, I'll get that E wedge F is equal to zero. And the second one, I'll just get that the theory is torsionless. Now the point is that if this is true, then this equation is automatically satisfied. So basically, it just means that E is a function of is determined, must be compatible with the connection, but then the equation here, which usually give the ancient equation, is trivial. So basically, this means that here the theory is GR, and here E is unconstrained. So it's kind of an empty theory. I mean, no, yes. Yes. So these two sectors are different when E is non-degenerate, meaning that the determinant is non-zero, but they can mix when the determinant is zero. So classically, I can really distinguish them, but quantum mechanically, I mean the path integral, when I'm going to sum over all, integrate over all possible values of the fields, these two sectors are going to get mixed together. So I'll have to try to do something afterwards to try to distinguish them and only get general relativity. So the one thing which is kind of strange about this approach is that, so I start with a theory, BF, and I add a constraint. Usually when you add a constraint to a theory, you kind of reduce the numbers of degrees of freedom of the theory. Here it's slightly different. By putting the constraint, you kind of add degrees of freedom, meaning that here, the initial theory, B, was basically just a Lagrange multiplier, which enforces the condition that the theory is flat. And now I impose a condition on the Lagrange multiplier, which means that there's more degrees of freedom in the theory, but the connection is not totally flat. So it's a strange approach where if I'm going to look at the main, at the first term and quantize it using spin foam techniques, and then I'm going to add that constraint, I mean, or that potential in B or that constraint, which kind of reduces the symmetries of my theory, which change its behavior drastically. So I guess that now I'm going to start doing the spin foam quantization of, oh no, I wanted to say something about the MEZ parameter. How does the MEZ parameter comes in that formulation? So the MEZ parameter is simply that you mix these two sectors already in at the beginning, meaning that if I call the MEZ parameter gamma, my initial action is epsilon E wedge F plus one over gamma of E wedge F without the epsilon. So now if you look at the equations of motion of this theory, then when the tetrad is non-degenerate, it's exactly the same thing as the first theory. So the only thing which distinguish the different theories with different MEZ parameter, it's the degenerate sector when E, delta of E is zero. So now if I have something like that, I'll just rewrite it simpler by putting all the E fields together. Then it's very simple, I'm just going to call that B. So that now I can rewrite this action as something on BF, I don't put the indices anymore, plus phi B wedge B, where the condition on phi is that I also take the other scalar made of phi. And this is the new condition that I put on the Lagrange multiplier here, so that this condition on the B field is going to be modified so that B is of this form. Is it visible? Okay. Oh, it's two numbers that I put, which are related to the immediacy parameter by, I'll write it here, that I think A2 divided by A1 is gamma plus or minus 1 over gamma. There's a 1/2 here. It's plus in the Euclidean case, it's minus in the Lorentzian case. So also here we see that we still have the same kind of thing, like two different sectors, which correspond to immediacy parameter gamma and immediacy parameter 1 over gamma. So kind of this approach doesn't see the difference between the two, which is kind of awkward from the point of view of Lucasian gravity, because gamma scales the geometric operators. So it means that a mixed theory where I've got, like, for example, imagine that gamma is large, like large eigenvalues of the error, and very small, because it doesn't see the difference between gamma and 1 over gamma. So all this is classical. So now I'll start doing the quantum theory of all that. So now what I care about is the path integral of this theory. So I want to look at the Poisson function, where I integrate over B over omega of this action on the manifold. So B which F plus phi B B. So as I said, I'm first going to start by looking only at BF. So I'll take care of this term later. And to make things more simple, I will do it in the Euclidean case first, and I'll give you the result in the Lorentzian case afterwards. And in the Euclidean case, when I look at SO4, SO4 is basically two copies of SU2. So I'll first do it in the SU2 case. And then I will go back to the SO4 case by putting two copies of the same theory. And then SO3-1, in the Lorentzian case, I'll just add some i's and minus everywhere. So when I look at this theory, as I said, B is just a Lagrange multiplier, which enforces that F is flat. So this is just going to be the integration on flat connections. So now what I want to do is to give a discretized version of all that. So I'm going to take again an arbitrary triangulation made of four simplices glued together with the tetrahedras and the triangles and all that. And I'm going to discretize the B field and the connection. So the connection is a one form, so it's going to be associated to like lines. So I'm going to discretize omega by group elements on each edge of a spin form. And then the B field is a two form, so I'm going to discretize it on surfaces. So I'm going to associate it to faces of my spin form. And the B is going to be valued in the Lie algebra, SU2. So these are small letters and these are big ones. Or maybe I'll make them bigger. So if you remember the correspondence I made between the triangulation and the spin form, the edges correspond to tetrahedras. So basically, this describes the parallel transport between one four simplex and the other one. So I've got one four simplex here, I've got the other one next to it. Between the two, they are linked by a tetrahedra, which is my edge of my spin form. And the group element just describes the parallel transport between the reference frame of this four simplex and the other one. Then here, if you remember, the B, the face correspond is dual to a triangle. So the B field, you can see it associated as to the faces of the spin form, but you can also see it associated to triangles of my triangulation, which can make it easier to understand. So now I'm just going to take the same action in the discrete case. So in the discrete case, I'm going to integrate over all b's, which are in SU2, over all group elements using the Haar measure on SU2. And then I'm going to take as action exponential of I of oh, yes. So here I'm going to take the trace of BF and some group element, which is also associated to faces. Because here I want something which corresponds to the curvature. So the curvature must be associated to like loops of my main loops. So what I'm going to do is that I'm going to take the group elements here on all the edges, and I'm going to follow them around each loop of my spin form, each face. So here I've got the element GE, which corresponds to each tetrahedra. And then I'm going to take to define GF as simply the product of all the GEs with the edge belonging to the boundary, the boundary of my face. So if you remember, as I said, that the surface is dual to a triangle. So basically, what I'm doing is that I'm looking at the parallel transport around the holonomy around each triangle of my 4D triangulation.
How do you decide your base point for G?
Here. Or you can take any one, because here this is going to be invariant, so you don't care about it. Well, it's simply, it's just because of the symmetry of the action. So here, I didn't put an I there, which is on purpose. It's not a mistake for once. it's that when I do that, and I take the trace on the fundamental representation of SU2, so as 2x2 matrices, then there's an I which pops out. I don't remember if Laurent explained that or not, so maybe I'll just say two words on that. So if you take a group element of SU2 in a fundamental representation, you can write it in terms of the Pauli matrices. So this guy is just cosine of the angle of a rotation times the identity plus I times sine theta times the direction of the rotation quadratic with the Pauli matrices. So now if I take an element of Lie algebra, so and I do the trace with G, B with sigma times G, then I still have the I which is here, which is going to come out. So I think in the notation of Laurent, he had called that thing P. So I just get I, B, dot P. And so because of the I, when I'm going to do the integration over the B field, I'm going to impose that P is zero. And if P is zero, then it means that the group element is just constrained to be the identity. So I'm going to get here, once I do the integration over B, I just get the same thing as in the continuum case, the integration over the connection of delta of my holonomies, which means that the theory is still flat.
Can I ask a question? So your spin form consists of two-dimensional faces and one-dimensional edges.
Yes.
And so despite of the fact that it was coming from four-dimensional space,
yes,
is there any difference between this and the
No. Yeah, I mean, the only difference is that here I usually think of everything on the 4D triangulation and not on the spin form. Also, you're going to get something different because usually in 3D you look at triangles, so you only have three valent intertwiners. So there's no freedom in there. Whereas here you're going to associate the intertwiners to the tetrahedras and you get to get four valent intertwiners, like in loop quantum gravity. And so you're going to get this extra freedom, which is going to make the theory a bit more. No, I mean, it's just if you write the amplitude on the spin form, then you won't see the difference. But then you must remember that the spin form is supposed to contain some topology. If, and there's two point of views. If you consider the spin form as the dual of a triangulation, then you still remember everything about the topology of the initial manifold and its boundary. And so it's going to be slightly different. But if you just forget the initial manifold and you just think about the spin form and the triangulation, then it might be very similar. But also here, it's just BF for SU2. So it's kind of natural. It looks like BF for SU2 in 3D. So the 4D thing is going to come also by the choice of the gauge group and also the constraints on the B field. Yeah, but you can quantize BF on any cellular decomposition. Yes, here I basically look at a triangulation because it's simpler to deal with, but I could consider a cellular decomposition with any shape of four cells and so on. But then it would be a pain to introduce all the notations. So where was I? So, okay. And now we have this guy. And we'd like to write it a bit more so that it looks less trivial. So to make it look less trivial, what you're going to do is that you're going to expand the delta function on representations of SU2. So here, remember that there's a product on all the edges of a triangulation. So when you expand the delta, you're going to expand the representation of SU2. So you're going to introduce a spin, which is going to be attached to each face of my triangulation. So I'm going to put a little index here. And here I've got a dimension factor. So here dj is simply the dimension of a representation of spin j. So it's 2j plus 1 times the trace on the j representation of gf. So here now we're going to replace gf by its actual definition. And we're going to perform the integral. So here we're integrating over the group elements on each edge. So it would be nicer if we can group all the GEs corresponding to the same edge together. And as Frank just said, if I take one edge, so one tetrahedra, then it has four triangles. So it has four. It corresponds to four faces. So each of these group elements for a given E, for a given edge, is going to appear four times in that integral. So I'm going to start swapping everything. So I said it appears four times. So first, you're going to replace that trace by when you have a trace of some product of group elements I'll just write it as the in terms of the represent matrices of each element, where all the sums are implicit. A1, A2, A2, A3, and then A1. So these guys have a Wigner matrices, so it just means that in terms of usual magnetic and the usual notation, it's just that guy. So now for each edge, as I said, I've got four of these matrices. Each of these matrices correspond to one triangle, so correspond to the different and the different representations associated to each triangle of my tetrahedra. So there's four triangles in there, so I'll just note that the representation J1 to J4, corresponding to the four triangles of my tetrahedra. So now the whole point is to evaluate this kind of integral. So it's here that all the intertwiners are going to come in. So here, because I was being lazy, I didn't put all the indices here, but are supposed to be here. So you can just put all indices. But okay, now I'm just going to forget about these indices and look at this operator here. So this is an operator which acts on the Hilbert space of representations of the tensor product of the four representations, where my notation is that this is the Hilbert space which is spanned by the vectors the usual representations. So spanned by all these vectors for m running from minus j1 to j1. So this guy acts on that, and actually this is the projector on the intertwiner on the space invariant, the subspace of that one invariant under SU2. So if I call this guy hj1 j4, I will call the invariant space with a little zero, just to make the difference. So this is the space of states which are invariant under the action of SU2, the simultaneous action on the four Hilbert spaces. So basically, I've got my four objects, and I'm going to rotate them together. And I'm going to look for objects which is invariant under this action. So if you just think about normal SU2 and spins, I mean, usual thing that you might be used to, this is just the space of singlets, if I take four angular momentum. And this operator here is just the projector from that space to that space. So in particular, it's simply the identity on this space. So now if I take a basis of this space, I can write this operator in terms of this basis. So if you remember all the stuff by Laurent, a basis of this space is can be represented with these little diagrams. Where I take an arbitrary spin on this extra edge there, or Thomas, I guess everybody's been talking about the same thing. And here, so I'll write it like that. This is a vector in this space, and it is actually a basis of this space. So this guy is simply means that I take these two spins and I'm going to put them to they form the angular momentum J. And since I want a singlet, these two ones must form the same angular momentum. So this is a basis of this space. So since this is the identity in this, on this Hilbert space, I can just write it in terms of these guys. So this is just the sum of a J of everybody understood? Nobody understood? It's trivial?
I understood.
Okay. Oh, yes, yeah.
So the bees are not constrained?
No, they are not. Okay, so now I've got all these integrals, and I'm going to replace them by things like that. So now I've got lots of index everywhere. Like, so if I take one for simplex, so here, my representation is that this is a tetrahedra, and I mean, and these are the five tetrahedras of my four simplex. Each line is the triangle which relates each tetrahedra. Everybody see the four simplex? It's okay, you can picture it. Okay, so now you're going to put one representation on each triangle. So I'm going to call them J1, J2. So one representation for each triangle. Maybe I'll just, JF, for each triangle. And then for each tetrahedra, which correspond to an edge, here you see that I'm going to introduce an extra representation. So for each tetrahedra, I'll also have a so that's which. And now, when I evaluate this integral on the tetrahedras, it means that around, I mean, at this point, so maybe I'll call that J3 and J4, I'm going to insert that little vector that I've put there. I'm going to insert that guy. I hope it's not too small. So I've got J1, J2, J4, and here I've got my J of my tetrahedra. And this guy is going to be the same, because I've got the two of them, is going to be the same on the four simplex on the other side. So that is the next four simplex, so there's lots of four simplexes, and this four simplex is glued with this one through this tetrahedra. And what's going to happen is that when you follow where are all these indices of these matrices, then it just means that you're going to contract this intertwiner here with the other intertwiners of this four simplex, and you're going to glue the same, which I forgot to draw, with the intertwiners of this four simplex. So basically, you see that when you evaluated this integral like that, you kind of like cut, I mean, you managed to cut the amplitude in terms of local amplitude associated to each four simplex, instead of having this object which was going through all four simplexes. So the only thing now which is going to keep these four simplices together is that the representation, the intertwiner that I've put here, is exactly the same that I've put there. So that's the only thing to remember, to keep in mind. So that at the end of the day, this guy can be written in the more complicated way, that I do the sum of all possible representations that I've put on the faces and representation that I've put on the edges. And I've got the dimension factor here that is there. And I'm going to have a product on all possible four simplices. So here we have vertices of my spin forms of the, what we call the 10J symbol, which is exactly that guy, meaning that I've taken my four simplex, I've added these little lines there, which correspond to the intertwiners. Maybe I should make it bigger. I said 10, I mean 15. So as I said, on each tetrahedra, I've opened the intertwiner. And so I've got the representation which corresponds to the faces everywhere, F1, and there's 10 of them because there's 10 triangles, and then there's 5 representation which are on each edge, so on each tetrahedra. No. And so if you count, there's 10 plus 5, and that's why it's called a 15J symbol. So this guy is the equivalent of the 6J symbol in 3D gravity. And here, because of the combinatorics of the triangulation, then you get kind of bigger objects. So 2 more minutes? Okay. OK, it's going to be very, it's fine. So next time, what I want to do is to put back the constraints on the B field. And this is going to impose some constraint on the representation, which in the case, there's different ways of implementing these conditions. But for the Barkan model, given by a particular implementation of this constraint. And in that case, this guy is going to be reduced to what I said earlier, a 10J symbol. So I just want to say one more thing, if I can. It's that the way we're going to do is something which can be generalized to any theory of the type BF plus any function of the B field. So if my partial function is of this type. And this kind of action is actually very generic. I mean, you can represent lots of things like that. You can have the BF theory. You can have you can have gravity. Here, you can try to put simply a term which is a cosmological constant, which is something in B wedge B. And in that case, for example, you're going to see that when you integrate over the B field, what you're going to get, something which it looks a lot like a Young-Mill theory, but is not really. There's an epsilon ijkl fij wedge fkl. And this is the topological Young-Mills, but it means that if you modify slightly this term, you can actually get Young-Mills theory. So for example, for Young-Mills theory, you would just take as action bj fij plus bij wedge Hodge dual of bij. And so this framework, this speed-form quantization, can be really applied to lots of theories and also can be applied to Young-Mills theory. So it's very generic framework. You don't get what? No, it's not clear how you can derive a Crane Rater model with a quantum group from this kind of thing. It's not totally understood how a cosmological constant gets into the quantum deformation of a Lorentz group. Well, I don't understand it.